And welcome back to Sourcing Matters. This is your host, Aaron Niederhellman. A few months ago, author and futurist Jack Aldrich wrote an article explaining that in 2019, General Mills, the manufacturer of Cheerios, Yoplait, Annie's Mac and Cheese, and much, much more, announced that they will begin sourcing a portion of its corn, wheat, dairy, and sugar from farmers who are engaged in regenerative agricultural practices and are committing to advancing the practices of regenerative agriculture on 1 million acres of land by 2030. Whole Foods announced that regenerative agriculture would be the number one food trend, and in spite of a pandemic, the rapid growth of online shopping overshadows the trend. Business interests in the field have spiked 138%. Most recently, PepsiCo announced that it was adopting regenerative agricultural practices among 7 million acres of its farmland. Cargill declared that it intends to do the same on 10 million acres by 2030, and Walmart has committed to advancing the practice on 50 million acres. Other companies pursuing regenerative agriculture include Danone, Unilever, Hormel, Target, and Land O'Lakes. So it sounds like this new land use model is all figured out. Could it really be this easy? Could we have nailed the five principles of regenerative land use and management? The fact that we have these five elements, the no disturbance, which is no-till, no synthetics, that we're bolstering soil's natural defense, which is that outer layer which protects its life, that we're instituting this and engaging with biodiversity, which marries to nature's way of keeping systems healthy, that we're instituting and also integrating living roots in the ground as long as possible through cover crops and seasonal diversity. And finally, as a fifth element, that we're putting animals and insects back into the integrated model, which nature relies on for the entire ecosystem health. Are we really ready to institute all of those things at scale using a production model that is completely different from the operating model and operating system that's currently used in conventional practice, all within short order? Heck, seemingly based on the mainstream commitments, this should be ready for broad adoption within this next decade. Maybe we could use this to meet the UN's 2030 SDG agenda? Well, just maybe. But first, we have some key questions here, like where's the knowledge share going to come from? Who says what is legit and what is not? Who's incentivizing these key stakeholders to partake? And what does a bimodal supply chain based off values really look like? And many more questions to come. Joining me to discuss what it'll actually take to make regen mainstream is scientist, farmer, entomologist, and former USDA Special Agent Bad Boy, Jonathan Lundgren. Welcome, Jonathan. Thanks for joining the conversation.
Well, it's great to be here. You summed things up pretty darn nicely right there, didn't you?
Well, thank you very much. So let's talk about it. Let's kick it off with that conversation. What's the story, and what is it actually going to take to make regenerative big time?
I think education are going to be two key elements. A crisis wouldn't hurt either, and that's not something anybody wishes for, but we do need to be ready for, and that does tend to spur a lot of innovation in our food system when things go awry, and things are going awry right now with our food system and on our planet. So there has to be data, right? We have to be driving our decisions using data. And right now, there's a lot of success stories in regenerative agriculture, and it looks wonderful, right? They are easily dismissed as anecdotes. But anecdotes are the basis of science. And now is when we need to actually be applying science and applying it correctly in order to analyze what is really the potential of regenerative agriculture. Once the data is there and it does seem as clear as it looks right now, then unfortunately we're not a data-driven society often enough. And so there's other factors, sociological factors, that need to be accounted for in order to make this sort of nonviolent revolution in our food system take hold.
It is fascinating. It is a bit of a, you know, in our space, which is slightly bit of a echo chamber where we're thinking, oh my goodness, how can people not be adopting this? it is a revolution, but you know, it seems that we're going to have to go through this evolution to get to the revolution. Are you seeing the same?
Yeah, absolutely. And evolution is a horrible thing to watch, right? It's messy, and not everything comes out on the other side looking the way that it did originally. And so we can be there for farmers and consumers and society that wants to make changes, but we can't force people into this either. So that's a painful thing to watch.
Yeah. Well, and I think to your point, you know, right, as you mentioned, anecdotes are a basis of science, or at least the theories behind, right, that we have to use that evolution to get more data. And you've recently just launched, this last week, the most ambitious agroecology experiment ever conducted, with aims to validate results, to get that data for regenerative agriculture. And you're doing this on 1,000 U.S. farms to provide a roadmap to transition our food system. So could you tell our listening audience a bit more about this 1,000 Regen Farm Initiative?
Boy, when you say it that way, I realize just how crazy this is, but it's absolutely necessary too. You know, so we formed Ichthyosis Foundation 6 years ago to try to rethink how science is applied in order to drive an evolutionary change in our food system. Science, as it is currently practiced, has helped to produce the industrialized food system, right? And using this tool, this tremendously valuable tool of science, in the same way that we have, isn't going to advance us the way that we need to. We have to rethink how we're applying this. Science has to be, scientists need to, number one, get away from their computer desks and actually get out and get their hands dirty again and connect with the problems that they're trying to solve. And this science that ends up happening is going to advance entirely new technologies, as well as cross geographic borders that currently are prohibiting large scale change driven by science. And so Ichthyosis Foundation has spent the last 6 years doing just this and developed this spine, this experimental spine that will run across the 10 ecoregions of the United States in order to conduct systems level assessments on regenerative farming systems. Essentially, the two questions we're trying to ask are real simple. Does regenerative agriculture work no matter what you grow and where you grow it? That's number one. And number two, how are farmers making this transition? And can we develop successful roadmaps in order to getting them there as quickly and painlessly as possible?
From your press release on the 13th of January, it mentioned that Ichthyosis Foundation today announced the launch of its groundbreaking multi-year project to use science, education, and monitoring to change agriculture in the next decade. The rigorous 1,000 Farm Initiative will be the most ambitious focused inventory on agroecology to date in evaluating the power of regenerative agriculture on a network of over 1,000 farms. So this is a multi-year initiative building this transition and this inertia behind it. So what does the schedule look like for farm adoption? Who and how will you analyze the data? And you know, when do we expect to start to see some results?
We're already publishing on this study. We've been cutting our teeth on a few key systems, cash grain systems in the Midwest, rangelands in the Southeast and the upper Midwest and Great Plains, and California almonds. And so those results are already established. Those are kind of the precursors of what we're going to be doing on a much grander scale. We're onboarding 500 farms for 2022, and we'll be up to 1,000 farms by 2023. And that, of course, is, you know, a loose number. It'll likely be probably closer to 2,000 or 3,000 farms that we'll actually have scientific teams on, boots on the ground, collecting data on deep carbon, soil micronutrients, soil health, water, microbial communities, invertebrate communities, plants, birds, nutrient density, and economics on each of these 1,000 points of light across the U.S.
And it's such a world apart from where you get, you know, the, back in the old days, even like 5-6 years ago, when you went to get a soil analysis, you know, for your backyard, for your farm, for anything, it was always about chemistry. It had nothing to do with the microbial and ecological infrastructure of the soil food web. And so now you're taking it layers upon layers deeper to really get a true and accurate depiction. But ultimately, this comes down to outcome measures, right? I mean, we're seeing that in science and human health and planetary health. It's getting this idea that outcome measurements are the key things.
Yeah.
Where are you going to take that outcome measurements? And when you gain this insight, how are you going to shepherd interest in the right direction?
So the inherent in the Thousand Farm Initiative is a monitoring plan. We're going to actually develop entirely new tools for monitoring how, from using spatial imagery, using sociological analysis and environmental analyses on these farms over a 10-year period. And so we'll be able to assess the impact that planting seeds of regenerative farmer champions into communities ends up exacting change, or investing in particular areas of the country where into regenerative farming systems ends up having a positive impact on entire, you know, landscapes or watersheds or regions. How do we shepherd people through? Well, that's a great question. We're scientists, right? And we're really good at science, I dare say. But we can't do it all. And that's been a really interesting evolution in seeing how this regenerative movement and players in the regenerative space have kind of evolved over the last even 3-4 years. When we were getting started, everybody was going to do everything. We were going to do the demonstrations, and we were going to do the education and the outreach and the marketplaces and the science, and everybody was going to have all of these things. And through time and experience, I think the identities of different players in this space have really become crystallized. And certainly it has for us. We're great at science. We're going to need partnerships in order to really, and we have a communications team in place, but we're going to end up needing to partner with a lot of other folks that are playing in this space right now in terms of their outreach and networking in with their communities.
Yeah, fascinating, because it is going to take this multi-stakeholder initiative, or at least these key partnerships, and there are a lot of individuals, as that lead had mentioned, that are towing the waters, or showing and expressing interest, and I hope it doesn't become flavor of the month and that it is that space, but at least we're legitimizing it. I think to your point of the farmers, the scientists, the on the boots on the ground model, even working with regulators on this. But what we've seen from those stakeholders and key players is there's a lot of third-party certifiers that are popping up, and even in regenerative, yeah. You know, Patagonia and Broner's, ROC, Savory's Land to Market, A Greener World has their own regen, and a handful of other proprietary programs that are launching this year. How do you make sense of it, and how do we make sense of that?
Yeah, there's I get contacted about once a month about somebody with a new verification or scoring system of this one's regen, this one's not. None of them have data behind them. And so in terms of, did this verification system that was developed behind a computer actually produce what it said it was going to? The only one that does is ours. And we spent $1 million to gather data that shows that a very simple scoring matrix can make some predictions in terms of soil carbon, life, economics, and that the more regenerative farms end up having higher values in these desired regenerative outcomes. So we've been, as these folks come in, we try to explain that this is not just a monitoring system. This has to be an empirical scientific experiment, and that we're really the only ones that are out there that are playing in this space that can do that effectively. There are other people that have scientific backgrounds, but this is what we're here for. So it's a pretty unique system that ICDISIS is running right now.
You'd mentioned empirical data, and do we have enough at that point? Because this transition to conventional has moved us so far afield. But or do you go back to authentic practices of growing food, you know, previous to this, the Green Revolution, to do some analysis or at least to create a framing of what this is going to look like? How did you assess and then build up that those guardrails to kind of, you know, bring this forward so that we can use empirical data appropriately?
Well, we were forced to do it, right? We had to do essentially treatment comparisons of regenerative and conventional farms. And so from a scientific perspective, and this has nothing to do with regulation, that's not really our interest, is we needed to practically have a way of distinguishing these two types of farms. And so what we did is we developed a matrix of different practices that support the general principles of regenerative farming. And what are those principles? You laid them out earlier in the show. There's practical ways of implementing those things, like no-till, cover crops, abandoning agrochemical use, livestock integration, organic amendments, things like compost and compost teas, managing off-farm plant communities. And just a yes or no question on a lot of those ends up providing us a pretty quick snapshot. Within a 2 to 3 minutes survey of 9 yes or no questions, we can walk onto a farm or onto a crop field and start to generate some predictions about what we might expect in terms of regenerative outputs. I mean, it's an extremely powerful tool that can be used practically by farmers to know where they fit on that regenerative spectrum. And we have one for rangelands too.
In that tool, that modeling approach, and they start to, you know, look at the data and the analysis and even probably projections on when they're going to see this come to fruition. Is it interwoven with capacity building for new farms or transitioning farms or, you know, large scale conventional farms that want to toe the waters in this? How are they, how did they start to make the transition with those models as that framing?
The transition becomes a separate question almost, a little bit. I think they're related. You know, how should a farm proceed with transitioning to regenerative? At this point, we are advocating full systems adoption rather than just a few practices. And that was also based on some of our observations from the what we're calling the Matrix paper, which is published in open access for everybody if they want to use that. Essentially, what we saw when we started to examine farms that fell along a regenerative spectrum in terms of the number of regenerative practices that they were implementing, we ended up seeing two clouds of data that emerged. You ended up seeing, and what those were conventional and regenerative farms. The potential for regenerative outcomes to be attained was much higher, or the productivity of the system was much higher for the regenerative, significantly so. But what was really interesting is that those two clouds were distinct, and you didn't survive long if you lived in the middle. And the reason for that is because, you know, this adopting one or two practices that are regenerative is a very difficult business model to maintain long term. And so maybe there's an opportunity to use that strategy for a transition. We'll find that out as a result of the 1,000 Farm Initiative. But at this point, you know, we would advocate for adopting the full system on a small scale and then scaling it up on your own operations.
Right. Yeah. I think one of the misnomers I receive for questions, or at least I think, you know, as this becomes more mainstream, the idea of regenerative is that it's just the next iteration of organic. So it's just another market ploy to get out there and get more, you know, more folks buying alternative to conventional. But it's very different. Could you explain to our audience the difference between organic and regenerative at least on the scientific side?
It's output. It's based on outcomes, right? The level of regenerative is based on how much soil health you're building, how much life you're aggregating, how much economics and nutrient density you're promoting in your operation. Whereas organic, and I think honestly, you know, regenerative shares a lot of similarities with the philosophy that drove organic adoption. The problem comes into when you develop a certification program that's based on practices instead of outcomes. And so, or the prioritization of practices instead of outcomes. And so you end up seeing things like tillage becoming a really big issue or a big component of organic systems. And I understand how and why that happens, but that is not in line with what the philosophy of organic was originally in terms of soil health and the promotion of life on a farm. Tillage is one of the most damaging things a farmer can do to their operation.
Right. Yeah, that is an interesting line of demarcation, that idea of that practice versus outcome. And it is, just even recent years, the consumer pressure, or maybe big box pressure, to include hydroponics into organic certification being an example, right? So good in the fact that it cleans up a lot of the persistent pesticides and contaminants to things, but very far afield from investing in soil health and a whole system infrastructure change.
That's right.
Yeah.
I think you nailed it right there. And that is what we've tried to do, is create a scoring approach or an evaluation approach for practices that can't be necessarily corrupted, that perfectly represent what's going on within those principles. The other element is, we hear a lot about carbon markets, and we hear all about carbon, carbon, carbon. And when you simplify it away from that system and away from those outputs, there it opens up huge opportunities for cheaters to move in. And we've seen this with carbon markets, and we've seen this with organic as well. So I think that it's really important to prioritize that system, and that's what a regenerative agriculture does.
Yeah, in that lead, I was trying to give a bit of a provocative thought in the fact that, could regenerative fall victim to this mass consumption of big ag and big food, that these overpromises may lead to compromise, like we've seen in organics, where ultimately people want something different. They want that differentiation and that values-based approach, but there's nothing else out there besides it. So, but in reality though, those big players, the big ag, big food, are essential, aren't they, for making this food system change? It can't just be us 2% aspirational players. It really has to be the volume of eaters and farmers that are adopting this approach. So how do you balance that? How can you stick to these outcome measures and still get the buy-in from these bigger players? Are we talking about the gray area in between? Are we talking about a differentiated model? You have a silver, gold, platinum approach. What's the best approach moving forward for that?
So a verification system is probably not going to be an effective way of implementing this. The only way of doing this is knowing your farmer, And understanding what's going on and having that connection with your food. I understand we have large urban centers. We have situations where consumers simply can't know their farmer right. And I think that's where large corporations and food distributors end up becoming really important. They need to be able to broker those relationships with the farmers. And there needs to be ultimately trust, doesn't there? And if you can trust that, I bought this product and it did improve my allergies, or it did, it does clearly support these farmers, or it is data driven, and pairing the science and including science within food communities again is inherent. It is really important. It absolutely cannot be avoided for this to be successful. Well, that trust ends up getting success. And I don't know. I think that those relationships are going to be what drives this forward. Is that Pollyanna? I don't
know. No, I absolutely think. I mean, that is, you know, food. I think the opportunity tied to food for consumers is it's a message of empowerment, right? It is a environmental and social consciousness. We can, you know, for those that are really trying to do something to better the planet or others, and as well as themselves, you can't find much better than regenerative agriculture, right? Because the whole system infrastructure is knowing the value chain. It is knowing the impact of all of those key things. You can't just sweep the externalities under the rug anymore. And it gives you a chance to vote with your dollars three times daily. And I think that is something that we've seen, at least from my point of view. And then again, maybe this is the echo chamber conversation. But that seems to be a macro trend, that people are looking for that type of that next step, that where the evolution will turn into a revolution. But maybe you and I are the same camp on that, and for the point of view.
We have data behind it, right? I mean, you've seen how your podcast has grown since you started. It was probably, I mean, I'm sure when you first got starting with Sourcing Matters, it was probably, you know, you were probably the fringe, right? And how has your listening audience grown and matured and changed over the last however many years?
Absolutely. You know, you hear from folks all over the world, different age groups, different interests, different beliefs, but absolutely realizing that food and connecting to soils and ecological systems are have huge potential and huge impact on what the future will look like.
Yeah. So, I don't think we'd be here at Ecdysis Foundation if this wasn't a real movement. I mean, honestly, we crowdfunded Ecdysis Foundation when we first got started. And so our very existence was validation that regenerative ag is something that's happening right now. And then when we put out our first call to producers, and it was, I think, one person posted something on Facebook, hey, this 1,000 Farm Initiative, we're just starting to onboard farmers for it. The response, hundreds of farmers instantly onboarded from, like, we're getting people from Africa and Germany and Australia and all over the planet. We want to be a part of this study. And it's like, oh boy, what did we just open, you know? So there's it's an exciting time, and this is a really important thing. History is going to look back on this as a turning point in our society.
I do agree. And so let's talk about that a bit more. If we've got producers that are listening that have interest, what's the process? How do they get to be part of these 500 farms in 2022? And, you know, is there a sequence of steps, or what's the best methodology to learn more about what you're doing with the 1,000 Farm Initiative?
Couldn't be easier. You just go to our website. That's ecdysis.bio. That's ECDYSIS.BIO. And on that website, there's a link that says register your farm here, and it takes about 2 minutes, and you'll be into our database. And then over the next couple of months, we'll be evaluating where the clusters are for 2022 and prioritizing those. And if you don't get in on 2022, don't worry, we might be able to get you in subsequent years. So
a lot of pent up enthusiasm and excitement for that. And are you adopting or accepting farms from, you know, an acre up to, or urban farms all the way up to 10,000 hectares, or, you know, what's your sweet spot?
Yeah, we're going to as we have with most of our science, we're letting the farming community sort of drive the bus a little bit here. So where are those clusters of interest and in terms of geography as well as food systems. So the priorities are, we'll be trying to focus primarily in the Western U.S. for this first year, unless resources allow us to expand to the whole country for this first year. We'll see.
Yeah. You had mentioned earlier in the chat here, and I just want to come back to this before we close out, with regards to carbon markets, which I think is a fascinating thing that is absolutely getting mainstream press. It's, you know, it's got a lot of money behind it. Obviously it's being touted as, you know, the ability for a farmer to have another crop being put on coming from their farm. So this additional pressure in the space from these huge multinational banks and financial institutions are, you know, that are trying to unearth this carbon market exchange in their soils and regen, from your perspective, how can farmers best deal with that? How can they not buy into the hype, but still, you know, there might be something there eventually. Is there a way to work with what you're doing to suss it out and to see if there is the potential for certain market exchanges where they can sequester into the ground?
You know, I don't think that there should be that a farmer, a regenerative farmer, should need a lot of incentives beyond their own business model in order to go regenerative. So any incentive programs that maybe their carbon markets, maybe their payments from the government or whatever, that should be gravy over your already profitable business model. And that doesn't mean you wouldn't receive a premium for a regenerative product, because that's a different entity, right? But farmers grow food and maintain a certain level of homeostasis in their operation through natural means and connection to the land. That we can't lose sight of that. And so our decision shouldn't be driven by other things. It should be driven on being a farmer.
Yeah. One last question, and I think this is just interesting insight from your point of view, because I think that, you know, as your scientific background, your work with the USDA, you're in a unique position where often the scientific community has been earmarked or commandeered by big agricultural companies. Still, the chem space that may be evolving to the biological space, but surely have not got to the ecological space. As a scientist, as speaking to other scientists, what is the future for them in this regen space? How can we get more of folks with your type of street cred and capacity and scientific and data analysis to get into this space so that we can continue to justify that this is the way of the future, that this is the practice that we have to get all stakeholders involved in?
Well, what's happening right now in all stakeholders, you know, I mean, what we're talking about is a paradigm shift in our food system and how we produce food, right? And so there's a lot of focus on, well, farmers need to change. And then we're like, oh, well, consumers also need to change, right? Oh, and the corporations, they need to change. The medical field needs to change. Well, the scientific community needs to change too. And right now, scientists are assessing their worth and value based on a set of metrics that is completely unconnected from the people that they're trying to help. And until we readjust those metrics of success for our scientific community, they're going to become more and more disparate from the central issues. Scientists have to be farmers. They have to live and feel what it is that they're trying to do. They have to get out and be connected with the problems that they're trying to solve. And, you know, right now, scientists are assessed based on how many papers they publish, how many grad students they pump through a puppy mill, how many grant dollars they get and feed into the bureaucracy of large universities or federal systems, or how many committees they served on. And I looked at the set of metrics. I mean, I was in that world. I was damn good at it, right? I mean, I was one of the top young scientists in the country. Obama gave me an award in the White House. I was good at those metrics. I had great statistics. And I looked at those and it wasn't satisfying. And I looked at those and I thought, you know, which of these do farmers care about? And it was none. And so Etic Dices Foundation, that's when I quit. And Etic Dices Foundation, you know, step one is the scientists have to be farmers and have to have that exposure to the land and to the animals that they're trying to raise. It's about becoming a part of a food community and those social interactions, face-to-face networking. So that's what needs. Yes, peer-reviewed science is important, but it shouldn't be the driver.
Fascinating. Great insight. And I think it's a great call to action. I'll add a call to action for just us laymen out there to say, you know, the opportunity for the citizen scientist too. I think Paul Stamets has used this concept too, right? It's like, get engaged, find, be inquisitive, get, find interesting books. There's so many good quality information that democratize these conversations. And to your point, when you get your hands dirty in doing this, the science comes along with it. There's a lot of opportunity to connect with these things. And hey, we're all eaters too. So how could you not be more vested in something like this? So it is a real opportunity for all of us to get into the scientific side of this too.
Absolutely. Yep, it totally is. And we're hoping that that becomes part of our monitoring efforts once the spine of this 1,000 Farm Initiative comes about. We can use those farmers and provide them with kits of measuring what's happening on their own farms.
Absolutely. More Renaissance folks, right? That's what we need. Engaged That's in right. it. So, well, Jonathan, I can't thank you enough for taking the time. I learned a great deal. I know our listening audience will as well. So thank you so much.
Oh, the pleasure was mine, and thanks for doing what you're doing here. We need more people like you getting the word out.